This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Properly done, mental health service advocates say there can be big savings from coordinated treatment and support of those with mental illness. But targeting who uses emergency rooms, police, and homeless shelters the most is key.
You'd pick out the highest utilizers. You know, it's going to be around $20,000 to support them, and it's going to be $50,000 or $70,000 to keep them in the jail.
John Fallon is a senior program manager for the Corporation for Supportive Housing. Hear from him, plus stepping through a crisis response, addressing early childhood responses to mental illness, and more in advance of McLean County's Behavioral Health Forum. That and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The statistics are staggering. Nearly everyone is touched by mental illness, and about 19% of the population is dealing with an ongoing mental health issue of their own. Tomorrow, the McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum brings mental health professionals, stakeholders, and the public together. The president of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, for Livingston and McLean County is Tasha Mox. One of her presentations is Stepping Through a Crisis Response. Tasha, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
When someone calls PATH, providing access to help, or 211 for some sort of mental health crisis, what happens?
Well, when they call 211, they are going to have somebody on the other line who is experienced that is going to be able to help guide them to what the next step is going to be. They're going to be able to connect them to the services that are available within our area.
So it could be somebody who is actually having a crisis. It could be a family member of someone who is in crisis. I assume the response differs.
Correct. So in that case, they're going to end up being connected to the crisis team, which would be the next stage of the level there, where it goes from PATH, then would connect them to the crisis team if they're in a crisis situation.
What kind of training do those at PATH or those kinds of similar organizations receive?
At the PATH at 211, they actually do have a training coordinator that trains them specifically. And I know I believe it's a 6 weeks course that they go through for that training.
So PATH serves 32 counties in central Illinois, is that right?
Yes.
And tell me about their level of service and the service they're able to provide in relation to the state budget crisis. Is that affecting them?
It is affecting them. As a matter of fact, they have had to get rid of their senior health insurance program that assists seniors with choosing their health insurance supplements, and that's had to go. But most of their other programs have been able to stay. So they still have 24/7 access to the information, referral, and their crisis response. They have adult protective services for people that are 60 years of age and older, and adults 18 to 59 with disabilities that are residing in McLean and Livingston counties. They have a self-neglect program that assists those that put themselves at great risk for harm for a multitude of different reasons. And then there is the linkage and benefits to permanent housing for those that are homeless here in the area.
You mentioned a crisis intervention team earlier. What triggers that team?
There can be numerous different things that trigger that. So when somebody calls 211, if there is there's a special need you'll have to come out to the forum to actually get what those actual triggers are for them. But they're trained to know. And when they recognize those signs, they'll go ahead and they'll call out the crisis team. We have a mobile crisis team in McLean County. And there's two different ways they can do it. They can actually call the crisis team. They can do an assessment over the phone, or they can actually go on scene. Now, once they get to scene, if they're by themselves as the crisis team, came, they can do an assessment there. If they feel like they're at risk, they can actually call a CIT-trained officer. A CIT-trained officer is a crisis intervention trained officer. So they actually have mental health training, which is something we really stress with at NAMI. I'm actually the president of the local affiliate of NAMI, and we stress that because that's one of our big signature things is CIT training. So the CIT trained officers in our area will go on scene, and if there's a problem, they're able to assist the crisis team. And it works both ways. So if CIT is, or if the officers are already on scene and they feel like they need an assessment, they can call the crisis team. If the crisis team is on scene and they feel like they need some assistance and there's a safety issue, they can call the CIT officers then.
We've all seen videos of an agitated person, sometimes with a knife or a rock. 911 is called, sometimes by a family member, and it ends tragically for that person, shot by police. How are these kinds of situations avoided? It's the officer that's had the proper training. It's the team that's had the proper training.
Correct. And we're very fortunate here in McLean County because we have gotten extra federal grants that have been put into place in order for our officers to be trained and our dispatch and our first responders to be trained for that training for the CIT trained officers and first responders, which is an excellent program for them to be trained under. And that's an actual, it's a 40-hour training session. So it's intensive mental health training that they have stimulations and everything that they go through. And so after that training, they're really more in tune with how to handle mental health crisis. And so it's really about de-escalation and how to de-escalate a problem instead of having to end badly. They know how to handle the situations better.
And can you talk about the actual crisis that someone may experience? What sort of things are happening? What qualifies as a mental health crisis?
Oh, goodness. So many different things can qualify.
A few examples.
For instance, it could be sometimes you could have, you may think that there's just somebody, you know, being naked running through the streets when really they could be going through psychosis and you don't know it. For instance, there's been episodes where somebody may have gone through psychosis and had a snap and committed murder even, and you may not know that maybe the reason why they've gone, had an episode and gone and had violent acts, but
so it could run the gamut from somebody not wanting to open the door,
right,
to murder.
Yeah, oh yes. It could be very simple. It could be somebody being trespassing on property and maybe being drunk and trespassing because they have nowhere else to go and being homeless. And that could be a mental health crisis where it seems very small, but yet it's very touchy because that person could really be suicidal and you don't want to harm that person or make it worse for that person.
So when does a team decide to bring in an officer? What causes that step to take place?
Well, anytime that you could put yourself in personal danger, it's time to call an officer. So if you ever make the decision that they need to be transported, it's time to call an officer in at that point.
And what about general training for all police officers, not just the specially trained officers that are on duty to respond to these kinds of incidents, but what about just for every officer?
Well, of course, it's important that every officer have some kind of training for mental health. We would love to see that the first aid mental health training that is going on here in our county is being at least trained to every officer if they can't get the CIT training. We would like to see at least that being trained to them. At this point, I know that the goal was when they were going through academy that we would get every officer CIT trained. Unfortunately, that didn't go, and in a way, that's kind of a good thing because we do want officers who have the heart for it to be trained versus every officer being required to be trained. Because if they don't have the heart and soul to be trained as a mental health provider like officer, we don't want them to be doing that.
But mental health first aid would be good for everyone.
Right.
And some of the things that someone receives, what are the tools they get through mental health first aid?
They'll get anything from how to recognize signs to what to do when they see those signs.
And are we expecting too much from police officers? I know they're first responders, but they keep getting more and more and more to do.
I think as an officer, since they are the first ones normally to be on a scene, since they have to be the first ones on the scene, it is a lot to expect, but as somebody who serves the public,
they need to know how to respond.
They need to know how to respond to us. I don't think it's too much for an officer as much as a first responder in general.
Thank you for appearing on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Tasha Mox is the president of the National Alliance on Mental Health Illness in Livingston and McLean County. She's presenting Stepping Through a Crisis Response at the McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum tomorrow afternoon. This is a special edition of Sound Ideas. You're hearing from presenters at the first McLean County Behavioral Health Forum tomorrow at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Coming up, find out how technology is helping mentally ill people. This is a special edition of Sound Ideas. You're hearing from presenters at the first McLean County Behavioral Health Forum tomorrow at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Coming up, find out how technology is helping mentally ill people. I'm Mike McCurdy. Early childhood trauma can cost society later without early intervention. Jennifer Lambert and Keith Brotheridge are licensed clinical social workers with the Baby Fold in Normal. Lambert is the program supervisor for Healthy Start and will address early childhood intervention at the Behavioral Health Forum. Brotheridge is a training coordinator with the Baby Fold. He'll address the effects of childhood trauma. Brotheridge broke it down in dollars and cents for GLT's John Norton.
And it's related to the Adverse Childhood Experience study, which I can speak to a little bit. But in terms of the economic toll of the 17,000 participants in this study who had a lot of traumatic experiences, $85 billion over the life course in productivity is the cost, $25 billion in healthcare costs, $14 billion in other social costs. And that is all came out of the Centers for Disease Control, CDC.
Jennifer, you're going to be talking about how to minimize early trauma. You say, there are five different ways? There are five methods?
Well, there's five protective factors that if you build those in your community or around a family, it will minimize the impact of trauma if it's occurred, or it will help those experiences not even happen. So, for example, one of the factors would be parental resilience. And basically, it's does the parent have the ability to manage the everyday life stressors that go on? So if they kind of have this strength within them or this kind of belief and optimism that things are going to be okay, I can do this, that allows them to be a little more free to parent their child, to be able to focus on their child, not necessarily to worry about all the other things going on because they're able to cope better.
That's one. You had some others as well?
Social connections. If you have a lot of support in your life, then you have people you can lean on when times do get difficult. So that's one of the other protective factors is knowing how to access concrete services when you're in need. So if you have, if you need childcare, but you have a lot of people around you, you can talk to them about, could you watch my child while I go to the doctor or while I go to work? My babysitter just quit on me. But if you're isolated and you don't know where to go in a community, the chances are you will just continue to live with some of those negative things in your life.
How much better are mental health specialists today identifying and helping people than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago? Do you have any data on that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't have quantitative data on that. I have my own personal thoughts.
Sure, that's fine. Yeah.
Since I've been in the field 25 plus years.
What's it like? What's the difference between now and when you entered the field?
I think it's very much more trauma focused, at least in the past 5 to 10 years.
Can you expand on that?
Just an understanding of the impact that complex trauma, chronic trauma like abuse and neglect have on children. And a lot of this research is coming out of neuroscience and neurobiology. Literally, the brain is structurally and sometimes functionally damaged by early childhood trauma.
Okay.
And you can see this through PET scans. The brain isn't operating correctly. Parts of the brain are overdeveloped and other parts of the brain are underdeveloped in these kids that have lived through complex trauma.
And that matters because 80% of your brain is developed by the time you're three. So if you don't have that opportunity for your brain to develop along the normal course of things, then, you know, that's going to be a huge impact on your ability to learn, your ability to socialize, to function in school.
And so much, like Jennifer said, the brain development happens between 0-3, 0-5, 80-90%, depending on the research that you read. Those years are crucial to mitigate trauma if we can. And that's where the early intervention comes in to help support caregivers and children, especially at the early age, because it's so damaging literally to the brain if left untreated.
I asked you at the beginning to talk in dollars and cents, hard numbers. Can you talk on a more emotional level, on a more personal level, on if this isn't taken care of, what actually does happen? Someone has a certain type of trauma. How does it manifest itself in a decade or two decades?
I don't know if this answers the question exactly, but I have also worked with foster children. So there's already some trauma going on in their lives. And now I work with children who haven't had that experience yet. And so I think for me, when we're working with these families, it's important to me because I know what may happen. I've seen what can happen as a next step when child abuse or neglect happens. So for me, the fact that half of our moms are adults from a child abuse or neglect background of some kind, but we only 4% of them do we ever have problems actually having an episode of child abuse or neglect. So I think from a prevention or early intervention standpoint, the impact is pretty big.
Okay.
And just from a data point of view in relation to early traumatic experiences, what the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experience Study, slightly over 20% of the participants, 17,000 plus people, had three or more ACEs out of 10 total. And here's some problem areas for students in particular. Students who had three or more ACEs had five times more attendance problems in school, six times more behavior problems, three times more academic problems, four times more health problems. And that still is children in school. As you work out and what the ACE study has found, problems strongly correlated with high A scores, three and more. Smoking, alcohol, drug use. ACEs are actually the best predictor of drug use in adult women. And again, we view alcohol or drug use with traumatized kids growing into adulthood is maladaptive coping with the trauma. And so it leads to these long-term health difficulties, lung cancer, heart disease, liver disease because of the drinking, the smoking, and the maladaptive coping mechanisms. So those are, again, just some of the data that's connected with the ACEs in the long term down the road.
Okay.
Impacts.
Over the years, have you seen more acceptance from law enforcement in understanding the effects of mental health?
I've seen a little of both. In my experience directly with some of the kids in our program, unfortunately, sometimes we have to have police involvement. And sometimes the police officers are very, what I would call, trauma aware.
Mm-hmm.
They understand the nature that this is a mental illness or traumatized kid that they're dealing with. But there are other officers that doesn't seem to come in or register in their mind. This is just a delinquent child, and we're going to treat this delinquent child.
I think that one of the other things that has changed is the acceptance of mental health issues. People talk about it more openly. One of the questions we ask when we're opening someone into our program is about their mental health background. And you would, I think 20 years ago, people would deny or not even know if they had some type of mental health issue. But now people, young people, say, you know, yes, I have depression, or yes, I have anxiety. So I think there is a different, the stigma isn't as strong now, and I think people are more willing to say what their struggle is. So I think that helps too.
And I think certainly what I've heard, there are some wonderful training programs that are happening within police departments in terms of crisis intervention. And a part of that is how to de-escalate somebody, how to understand, is this person mentally ill? Does this person have a substance abuse issue and or trauma in their background? So I know that there are training programs that are happening with police, which is very encouraging.
Keith Brotheridge and Jennifer Lambert, licensed clinical social workers with the Baby Fold, talking with GLT's John Norton. They say another way to look at the societal financial benefit of early intervention is that it costs $4,000 a year for a family to go through Healthy Start with the associated support. If the trauma for the child becomes so severe that they end up in residential treatment at the Baby Fold, the cost is $182,000. At the Behavioral Health Forum, Brotheridge will address the effects of early childhood trauma. Lambert will talk about the impact of early childhood intervention. You're listening to a special edition of Sound Ideas with presenters from the McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum tomorrow at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. I'm Mike McCurdy. School systems have added services so that calls to police are not the first recourse. GLT's Judy Valente has more with Mark Jontry, Regional Schools Superintendent for McLean, Livingston, Logan, and DeWitt Counties, and Brenda Huber, the Director of the Psychology Services Center at Illinois State University. Both are on a panel about mental health in schools for the Conference on Behavioral Health held at the BCPA tomorrow. Jontry says while there has been progress when it comes to mental health services in the schools, much still remains to be done.
Children are coming to school agitated. In some instances, it's a product of issues at home in terms of their family dynamic. And so kids are just coming to our schools with more and more behaviors that are a real challenge and an obstacle to learning, not only for themselves, but for their classmates.
You're here with Brenda Huber, who is from Illinois State University and an expert in early childhood behaviors. Brenda, how much of this comes to you from the home, and how much can you really affect by the time a child gets to school age?
We know that statistically, well over half of the kids that we have in schools have experienced some real adverse experiences prior to coming to school and ongoing. Some people call that trauma, you know, those experiences that are so emotional and upsetting that they have an impact on the way the child learns. And there's quite a bit we can do in the schools to teach children how to manage those emotions so that they don't serve as a barrier to learning.
Before we get to some of those techniques that you use to help children through this, what are the types of traumas specifically? What do you see commonly?
You know, there's, of course, abuse and neglect, which is kind of where everybody's head goes when we talk about trauma. But there are a lot of other things, witnessing violence in a neighborhood or even some of the things that kids are exposed to in the media, as well as in their own families.
So, Mark, what do you do? How do you help them? What's step one when a child comes with trauma or a behavioral problem?
Well, that's kind of what we've been doing as part of our behavioral health in schools group. Over a year ago, we convened this group in McLean County, and with the intent, the basic intent was to address the question, how can school personnel tell us more about the behavioral health needs of our kids, and what can we do about it? And so corresponding to that is really inventorying what resources do we have in schools to address that, be that guidance counselors, social workers, psychologists, and where are we still lacking and where do we need those supports from social service providers? Are they supports that we can bring into the schools in the way of curriculum that target those issues? So for the last year, we've been meeting regularly with a group that includes our school personnel, our social service personnel, our providers, to try to get a handle on, all right, what resources do we have and where are our gaps and how can we better align our efforts to try to bridge those gaps.
Brenda, what specific techniques do you use or practices do you have? Mark's given us a nice overview.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we realized as we looked at the needs in the community is that teachers and educators were telling us that the number one resource they went to when they had kids with difficulties were the police or maybe DCFS, but not
necessarily accessing supports. And we realize that many children have needs. Well, all of our children have needs, obviously, but we had children not accessing the supports that were intense enough or frequent enough. So we divided up our entire population of kids into four categories. There are kids that don't need anything but the regular school day and the natural supports that are happening. But there are children that need a little bit more to get their social-emotional development on track. And so for those kids, we do things like groups, targeted groups that might be supporting, say, anger management or how to cope with anxiety, those kinds of things. And then there are kids that have already really developed some significant problems, and we do a lot of individualized work with them. And we're coordinating with the community resources so that those needs at that level don't fall only on the school psychologists and school social workers and school counselors, but also utilize the expertise that we have in the community in a really coordinated way.
Do you give the children and students these services right in the school, or where do they go outside of the school for these services?
Most often we're providing the services right in the schools because it does overcome these barriers to transportation and other things, especially in the rural areas of McLean County where it's a long distance to get to a provider. And the schools have been really the service hub for those youth. And then we're piloting some programs that put community partners in schools and extend beyond the school day and also provide services in homes and other community settings.
Mark, you mentioned that one of the first thoughts that people have when they encounter a child with a behavioral problem is call the police, get the police in. Should that be a last resort?
A last resort in terms of depending on what the issue is. I mean, the county in their plan is spending a significant amount of resources to get all of our first responders trained in a lot of crisis skills. You know, we've had a lot of individuals get trained in mental health first aid. We're going to have more individuals trained in mental health first aid to understand how to react and respond to that. There's a training that's targeted to adults, and there's a training that's specifically targeted to youth. Our nurses in many of our schools have actually gone through the youth mental health first aid, and those trainings continue to be offered.
How well are teachers equipped to deal with behavioral issues in the schools?
You know, there's a lot we've been doing in this group to look at what teachers are mandated to be trained in, because there are a number of things that the law requires them to be trained in, and what they need. And what they need to support the more social-emotional needs of our students. And so there's a concerted effort right now in the county to be intentional about the training of teachers so that they're getting exactly what they need for working with the youth. The other thing is that we're partnering with some community agencies to bring in some evidence-based programs to prevent suicide and to prevent the use of substances to cope with difficulties. And so I think in those ways, if we can get those programs to virtually all students as they age through, we're also providing supports to teachers to apply those skills that the children are learning, apply those throughout the school day and in other settings.
How much of an issue is suicide among the school age population that we have here in the county?
I work in several counties around this area. Interestingly, our data in McLean County shows that our number one problem is bullying. Mm-hmm. All kinds of bullying is our number one reported concern from youth. That doesn't necessarily translate into suicide or suicide attempts. Our suicide attempts are not any higher than surrounding counties. However, in a recent needs assessment done by our hospitals and our health departments, suicide and coping skills around suicide to prevent suicide was one of the top three priorities that they came up with. And so some of the programming that's happening now in the schools has come out of that needs assessment.
How much help or pushback, shall I say, do you get from parents? Because I would imagine that parents are a big part of helping children who do have behavioral problems. Mark or Brenda?
I think a lot of that comes down to how it's presented. A lot of times, some parents are really struggling with what to do with my kid. And if we have the opportunity to present them with some solutions and some options, I think you would be hard-pressed to find very many parents that wouldn't embrace that opportunity. By and large, the opposition to this help is not there, and it, in many cases, I think it's welcomed.
Brenda, what are we lacking? What do we need to do going forward?
We have quite a few resources in McLean County, so our efforts have been to figure out how to maximize those resources so that we don't have a bunch of people doing the same things that might not be as needed. You know, for example, everybody going into the same school building while there are other school buildings that don't have any community agencies coming in to provide support.
Is that a situation where some schools have nothing and others have a lot?
Sure, sure. So we're being really intentional about how we make sure that students have equitable access to these kinds of supports.
So many social service agencies, school-related educational agencies are really struggling under the budget cuts or the budget impasse in Springfield. How has that affected your work in the schools in mental health?
It's really been tremendous. The schools are really struggling, even though, publicly, people think the schools are one place that's getting money. They're not getting the money that they need in order to really meet all the needs of the children. What we know is that if we don't address the social-emotional needs, learning is compromised. And when we do provide those social-emotional supports for all children, we see academic performance and overall graduation rates and things improve.
Well, Mark Jontry of the Regional School System and Brenda Huber of Illinois State University, thanks so much for talking about this very important issue.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Jontry and Huber mentioned bullying as one of the biggest behavioral problems in schools. According to a 2014 Illinois Youth Survey compiled by the University of Illinois, 42% of sixth graders in McLean County schools reported being subject to bullying. The reason most of those students cited for the bullying was their physical appearance or a disability. You're listening to Sound Ideas. This is a special edition of Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You're hearing from presenters at the first McLean County Behavioral Health Forum tomorrow at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Technology has been a driving force behind improvements in healthcare. The development of specific software that helps healthcare professionals track data in order to fight diseases. Nurses and doctors are now routinely using handheld computers to record important real-time patient data and then share it instantly with their updated medical history. And for those seeking help with behavioral health issues, telepsychiatry can aid patients in a variety of ways. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Technology is increasingly removing barriers for those seeking help with behavioral health issues. Renee Donaldson is showcasing the advantages of telepsychiatry at the Behavioral Health Forum. Donaldson is the Service Area Administrator for Behavioral Health Services at Advocate Broman in Normal. Part of her job entails overseeing the inpatient psychiatry unit. Donaldson says telepsychiatry as part of telemedicine has been used at Advocate for a short while now, but it's already made a positive impact on patients.
Here at Advocate, we implemented the use of telepsychiatry close to 2 years ago now.
So what is exactly telepsychiatry? I mean, is it literally just Skyping with a doctor?
We do have a machine within the hospital setting, and if the patient consents to being interviewed by a psychiatrist, the machine or the equipment connects with psychiatrists that are housed at Advocate Christ, that is up in the Chicago area. What we focus on the medical units is meeting the holistic component of the patient. So the patient could be presenting with medical needs in the hospital setting, and they may be experiencing some anxiety or some depression. They may be experiencing some grief and loss issues. They may be struggling with stress management, and we may be able to utilize telepsychiatry for those situations. It is truly driven by the individual needs of the patient. We try very hard to individualize the care at our hospital. you find telepsychiatry utilized in rural health areas. For example, there are some states in the United States that do not have psychiatrists in a long, mild radius, and so they can utilize telepsychiatry to get the needs of the patients or the people met via telepsychiatry located in someplace else within the state, or it could be potentially out of state.
Well, this sounds like a big need that's been filled through technology for rural areas.
Yes, for rural areas, but we're also utilizing it here in central Illinois to connect with specialists that may be able to meet needs that other areas of our community cannot do that.
Well, let's talk about some of the subspecialties we might find with telepsychiatry.
At the present time within Advocate, we utilize psychologists and psychiatrists and advanced practice nurses through the telepsychiatry components.
Patient-wise, who is a good candidate for this type of treatment?
At Advocate, we are utilizing it for behavioral health patients who may have certain needs, as well as we are currently screening for patients that are on our medical units to make sure we are treating the holistic patient. So if you are coming to Advocate with potentially a medical condition, and we are screening you for anxiety or depression, and there is a need identified there, we may be able to connect our patient with a psychiatrist or a provider in what we call the hub out of Christ Medical Center.
So you could be dealing with somebody who's hundreds of miles away from you.
That is correct.
So what are the differences with traditional treatment and telepsychiatry? What can you expect and what can you not expect from this?
It really depends. It is dependent upon the individual need of the patient. The one thing that you cannot expect is to have an in-person interview with two humans sitting in the same room. That's not going to happen. One's going to be on a machine and one is going to be in the room. That, to me, is the biggest difference because we can provide lots of services to meet the client's needs.
Is this different from somebody who goes to see a therapist every single week, you know, lies down on the couch and spills all their problems? Is this something that's more specific or is this something that would be done on a weekly basis?
For how we utilize telepsychiatry at Advocate at the present time here in Bloomington Normal, it would be different than somebody who is going and meeting with a psychiatrist in an outpatient clinic or meeting with a therapist in an outpatient clinic, because Advocate Medical Group and Advocate Broman Medical Center do have a broad range of services. So at the present time, we are able to meet the needs of people who need individual therapy on a weekly basis or need to meet with a psychiatrist.
Are there specific and unique guidelines for telepsychiatry?
Our biggest concern is that we need to have the patient consent or authorize this type of service. There are times when the patient may say, you know, I'm really comfortable addressing this with my primary care physician. Some of the needs that patients present with, the attending physician within the hospital setting may be able to meet those needs. So we try to utilize our resources in the best possible manner.
Are there any privacy issues that we need to be concerned about with regards to this, with the technology end of things?
We ensure that a patient's confidentiality or a client's confidentiality is protected when we are utilizing our telepsychiatry machine.
Does insurance cover something like this, or is this just still too new?
I believe it is dependent upon the individual insurance that the patient or client is carrying.
So you feel really confident that this is really a bold step forward, and this is something that's going to become very much the mainstream.
I think that it really depends on your geographical location and what is available in your community or surrounding areas. Because again, you have rural settings that don't have access to therapists or psychiatrists. So that may be a venue that that community tries to engage in to meet the holistic needs of their community members.
What sort of advantages are there for the healthcare professional who is actually getting involved in this? Not the patient, not the client, but the healthcare professional.
I think the goal for the healthcare professional is to make sure we are encompassing a holistic approach for the patient. If telepsychiatry helps keep a patient out of the hospital setting, that is a positive approach and win for both the patient and the healthcare provider.
What do you see as the future for telepsychiatry? Is it wide open?
I think for telemedicine in general, not just telepsychiatry, I do think that it is wide open when you're looking at where we as a nation are going with electronics and those types of capabilities, I think there are lots of possibilities out there.
One day, perhaps, what you're offering could be offered as an app. Somebody could just download it.
That does remove the human touch, but that is potentially something that people are wanting. I just do think it's important from a community perspective that we acknowledge that this is a service that's available. And just to complement the community with where we're going from a behavioral health perspective in general. We are always open to feedback from our patients. In fact, that's how we look for providing the best possible care, looking at process efficiencies and improvements is anytime we receive feedback from our patients or caregivers or family members, we take a look at how we can make our service delivery better.
You feel very positive about this aspect of healthcare, this holistic approach using technology.
Absolutely. I think it just brings a mechanism that may have not been there before that we can offer and gives us an opportunity to expand the overall care for the patient.
That's Renee Donaldson, Area Administrator for Behavioral Health Services at Advocate Bro-Men in Normal. Her topic at the Behavioral Health Forum deals with telepsychiatry at Advocate Bro-Men. I'm Laura Kennedy.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to a special edition of Sound Ideas with presenters at the first McLean County Behavioral Health Forum tomorrow at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. You're listening to GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Earlier in this special edition of Sound Ideas, Brenda Huber with ISU's Psychology Services Center said coordination of services is key to helping school-age children with behavioral health challenges. Coordination has also been a barrier to care for adults, and that idea was one of the keys behind a study of mental health services in McLean County that's led to the jail expansion and tomorrow's Community Behavioral Health Forum at the BCPA. Coordination is also key to an idea called supportive housing, in which communities try to take a big chunk out of the expense incurred in treating mentally ill adults by bringing services to them instead of making them go to the services. GLT's Charlie Schlinker talks with John Fallon, a senior program coordinator with the Corporation for Supportive Housing. Fallon is the keynote speaker for the forum. He says communities should not view housing for users of community mental health services as a free handout.
You know, we wouldn't blame someone who wears glasses if you didn't give them the glasses. You wouldn't blame someone who can't walk. We'd give them a wheelchair. We wouldn't expect them to use the wheelchair for, 3 months and then give it up. We would know that that's the support they need. And supportive housing is simply an approach which can be done in scattered site, or it could be single buildings. It could be an individual apartment, or having the services right available, or having the services come to them. The difference is that the support services need to be delivered in a person's house, because the people who are able to take advantage and use supportive housing to not live in institutions are not people who can take advantage of the typical services other people can use. So someone who ends up in jail, or someone who ends up in the psychiatric hospital or the emergency room, those are three separate instances where traditional community support didn't work. And so the question is that something that happens for a short period of time, or is that something that the person needs ongoing long-term support, like glasses or a wheelchair?
What kind of services?
The services will vary, and they should be based on the individual and not a requirement in order to live in the housing. And then the second thing is that if a person is only able to earn a limited amount of income, it turns out to not be that helpful or cost-effective to have them live in a bad neighborhood when they're already vulnerable, or in a place where there's no jobs, or a place where there's large numbers of people with the same disability or needs. Or rather, people need a chance to be in the same neighborhood they grew up and be able to use the supports. You get help from your family and living in the neighborhood and using the strengths of your family and your church community and those kinds of things. And so we need to make sure that the housing is affordable for the person and is in the neighborhoods they want to live in. We now know how to do public housing. correctly or government-funded housing.
For those looking at a bang-for-the-buck analysis, how much more cost-effective is it to fund something like supportive housing than to continue to let these super users show up at emergency rooms, addiction clinics, and hang around on street corners?
I worked for Thresholds, which is a mental health community, for a lot of years before I came to CSH. And I had lots and lots of people who had, you know, long histories in and out of jail. And you have people with the necessary support for medication and help managing their day-to-day living with on-site services as they need it, which for a lot of people was, you know, 20, 25 minutes a day, but it had to be on the weekend and holidays as a person needed it and as they requested it. But we were able to stabilize people. So here's what we know. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities who live in the state-operated facilities, the developmental centers, the cost for that is around $250,000 if you just take the number of individuals there and you look at what the cost annualized is, you come up with $250,000. Yeah. For someone with a psychiatric illness, it's $150,000 or so to stay in a state institution for a year. Our prisons are typically somewhere right around $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And in our jails, it's a little closer to $60,000 a year. I don't know particularly what McLean County is, but it's more expensive in the jail than it is in the prison because you have a lot of transporting people back and forth between court and the jail. And, you know, in all those cases, you have the people with mental health cost additional money for formulary medical services and extra staff. And then we have emergency health care through the emergency room. And we have people with severe mental illness and with substance abuse problems who are probably right now, there's two or three people who are off-boarded, meaning they're taking up a room in an emergency room and no one knows what to do. And in a couple hours, they may be back. Well, all of those are individuals that can be served for around $20,000 for services and to bring the rent down enough so that they can remain in the community and give an alternative for a police officer to bring them back home if necessary rather than to the hospital or to jail, for workers to be able to be available and on call and to be able to talk with that individual and make sure that they're okay and that they ask for the services. And some of that takes some practice, but you know, I saw 80% reductions in emergency room use, hospitalizations, and arrests in my work.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Fallon of the Corporation for Supportive Housing. He's the keynote speaker at McLean County's Behavioral Health Forum at the BCPA on Thursday. How do you make sure that the assets that are no longer being spent on one service provider go in part to bolstering supportive housing? How do you apportion costs fairly to prevent profit-taking by some agencies?
Well, we need knowledgeable voters to figure out, you know, when I get my paycheck, it's got a whole variety of people who take my money, the state government, the federal government, potentially sometimes local government, or that happens between intergovernmental transfers. And then there's multiple different sectors of each of those levels of government, and they all fight over their individual budgets, but together it all comes out of my paycheck and everyone else's paycheck. And so we as voters need to make sure everyone works together. But using a process we call FUSE, or Frequent Users Service Enhancements, and going through the process of find your most expensive people, figure out what investments necessary to avoid expensive services, and make sure you can get it. And that process identifies those most expensive people. So in the case of the project that I was involved in, we did it with foundation money initially to demonstrate it was acceptable. The state then picked it up and funded the rest of it. So initially there may be an outlay from local government, but then it can get picked up by the state and then the federal government through Medicaid if done correctly. And we also need to take advantage of federal resources. I mean, we have lots of states that get more return on their tax dollars than does Illinois. Then going back to what you first asked, I can't guarantee that the money, the cost savings will end up where it's supposed to, but I can say that there are communities that are very effective at making sure that they're using other people's money in order to save money, get more effective, and increase public safety.
In my 25 years in this community, I've seen coordination of service come up as an area that was lacking in a variety of fields. Domestic violence, substance abuse, job retraining is another area. Sometimes an effort to change that turns into a moonshot that isn't sustained. Other times it results in lasting change in the way agencies play nice with each other. What makes for the latter case in breaking down silos for good?
Well, you have to make a long-term commitment to the idea, and you have to make sure that your workforce is trained to implement it, and you have to do your best to make sure that people are going to continue an idea longer than a single administration, and that you embed it in the way you practice and what you do.
John Fallon is the keynote speaker for Thursday's Community Behavioral Health Forum, hosted by McLean County Government at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts from 1 to 6 p.m. Fallon spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find Charlie Schlenker's interview at WGLT.org. That's also where you can hear the rest of the interviews with presenters at the Community Behavioral Health Forum. Thanks to Judy Valente, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. Find the full show podcast at our website or at iTunes. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us at news@WGLT.org. Or tweet, use the hashtag SoundIdeas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.